Welcome back, or I'm sorry, welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio's health rating is clouded by smoke. A new report from the Health Policy Institute of Ohio found that 22% of Ohio adults are smokers and that 1 in 10 children in Ohio live with a tobacco user. And those trends affect the state's overall health. And that affects other things. Joining us now is former senior advisor to the FDA Center for Tobacco Products and Ohio State University assistant professor in the College of Public Health, Micah Berman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And also vice president of prevention and public health policy at the Health Policy Institute of Ohio, Amy Bush Stevens. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Amy, in your report, you found that tobacco use not only affects health, but also healthcare costs. How does it affect healthcare spending in Ohio?
So it certainly drives up spending for employers. It's also a concern for the state from a policy perspective, looking at what the state spends on healthcare for state employees and then also through the Medicaid program. So research estimates that about 15% of Medicaid expenditures are attributable to smoking. And there was a recent study from Indiana that compared per member per month expenditures for Medicaid for smokers versus non-smokers. And they found that the spending was 51% higher for smokers.
How does Ohio rank nationally? How do we compare to other states?
So that's really something that stands out when we look at the results of our health value dashboard. Ohio ranks 43rd on adult smoking and 49th on secondhand smoke exposure for children. So we're really in the bottom quartile here and have lots of room for improvement. And this is a concern because tobacco use contributes to many of the other challenges that we see pop out in the dashboard, things like cardiovascular disease and, of course, infant mortality.
The bottom quartile, it's hard to imagine that Ohio's in the bottom quartile on something like this. Just really about one in five people smoke, though, still, right? Adults.
Yeah, we definitely have seen progress.
Yeah.
So the rate has definitely come down. So in the early 2000s, we were more at around 28%. Now we're at about 21% of adults who smoke. So we have seen progress. And, of course, in the early 2000s, we had a really significant investment in this state with the master settlement dollars invested in prevention and cessation. So really preventing youth from starting in the first place, helping adult smokers to quit. We have continued to see a gradual decline in our adult smoking rate since that time. And certainly youth cigarette smoking has declined quite a bit. But other states, I think, have been more aggressive and have seen faster progress in bringing those rates down.
Micah Berman, let's talk a little bit about what the effects of smoking are, and secondhand smoke especially. I hardly ever see anybody smoking anymore anywhere except maybe in little huddles on street corners, it seems like, because it's banned in most public places now.
That's right. So Ohio voters in 2006 passed a comprehensive smoke-free law, which was actually the first state outside of one of the coasts to pass a comprehensive smoke-free law, and Ohio was really a leader. The problem was that for a lot of policymakers, after that law was passed, there was an assumption that now we've dealt with this problem and we can move on. But that's not exactly how it works, and the tobacco industry is still investing very heavily in marketing and promoting their products. They spend more than $1 million a day just in Ohio. So if we don't keep focusing on prevention and protecting the next generation from starting to smoke, then we're still going to have problems making progress overall.
And you mentioned birth weights, Amy Bush Stevens. Was it birth rates or birth weights that you mentioned is affected by this?
So mothers who smoke are more likely to have babies with lower birth weight.
Okay.
So it is one of the contributing factors to infant mortality. Secondhand smoke is also a risk for sudden infant death syndrome. But I think it's important to keep in mind when we think about this connection with infant mortality that quitting smoking is really difficult. Nicotine addiction is a powerful addiction, similar to other addictions that we see, like to opiates or alcohol. And people need really serious help to quit sometimes. So as we think about that, it's important to think about helping pregnant women or really all people of childbearing age to quit smoking.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about smoking. The smoking rate in Ohio is down to about one out of every five adults, but one in 10 children are exposed to secondhand smoke or live with a smoker. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, if you're a smoker and you're thinking about quitting, but something's holding you back, give us a call and tell us what. 614-292-8513. Amy, your report indicated that there's a large disparity in adult smoking by income level. 39% of adults with household incomes less than $15,000 smoke. Smoking is expensive. When I quit, it was about a buck a pack. That was 30 years ago. It's a lot more now. How can they even afford it?
Yeah, we do see really big disparities by income level and also by education level. And by geography as well. We also see higher rates of smoking among folks with disabilities and people with behavioral health conditions. So that is a real concern. I think if you think about folks living in poverty who are dealing with struggles to, you know, maintain housing or put food on the table, quitting smoking may not rise to the top as their immediate.
It may create a stress that they just.
Right. And I think smoking is seen as a way of coping with stress. So for people who are living with a lot of stress in their daily life, it can be particularly difficult to quit. And I think what we see is some reduction in consumption of cigarettes, but still people having a hard time quitting completely.
So, Micah Berman, you're down to this 22% of adult Ohioans still smoking. What is the breakthrough for them? What's this next step?
Well, Ohio, once we passed the smoke-free law, actually cut a lot of the support that it was providing to help people quit, and also cut a lot of support for its prevention programs. And I think that's why we have been a little bit stuck. The smoking rate, as Amy mentioned, is going down, but not nearly as fast as it is in other states. And so smoke-free law was important, but we need to still keep investing in helping people to quit. Ohio is one of the very few states that doesn't fully fund its quit line. So that 1-800-QUIT-NOW number that people in almost any other state can call and get free support. Only some people who qualify in Ohio are able to get support from that quit line. And prevention programming, Ohio has fallen way down on the list. So there's a lot more that can be done, both to help people quit smoking and also to keep kids from starting to smoke.
It doesn't look like there's going to be much money for that this time around. They're looking at these big cuts, or they're not that big of cuts, but it looks like it's practically a flat budget.
The governor, in the governor's proposal, did suggest raising the cigarette tax by 65 cents.
To spend on this?
Well, that the proposal did not include spending it on smoking prevention, but that's something that a lot of the public health groups have been advocating for, that at least some part of that money be set aside to be used for prevention, because increasing the cigarette tax would bring in a lot of money, but it would also increase the costs, obviously, on people who do still continue to smoke. So I think if you're going to do that, it is only fair to take some of that money and reinvest it in helping people to be able to quit.
When we talk about the addiction to nicotine, to cigarettes, there's the emotional addiction to cigarettes, the act of smoking, the process of it, and then there's the physical addiction as well. Is there a sense about what's the tougher of the two, or are they equal, or what, to break through?
It's very hard to disentangle.
Distinguish them, yeah.
And I should mention that Ohio State has a center that's focused on tobacco regulation and research. And we've been looking into a number of these issues and following groups of both kids and adults in Ohio and both the Columbus area and in Appalachian parts of the state. And so this is one of the issues that we're working on. But What's interesting, and this is not research at Ohio State, but from elsewhere, is that even if you take out some of the nicotine, a lot of the nicotine, people will quit smoking in higher rates than we actually had expected, because we thought that taking out the nicotine, people would still look to smoke for all these other reasons.
The
that you
emotional
mentioned, but
attachment.
It actually seems that people actually are able to quit once you take out the nicotine. So that's one of the things that the FDA now has the power to regulate nicotine levels, and it's one of the things that they will probably be looking at in the future.
Interesting. That's really interesting. So the emotional is just too wired into the addiction.
It seems that the nicotine probably is the primary driver, although there certainly are other effects as well.
What kind of programs do work? I mean, if you could have your ideal setup, what would it be, Micah Berman?
It's actually a combination of things. So there's no one thing that works, and there's certainly no one thing that works for everyone.
Okay.
But it seems that it's actually the combination of some sort of behavioral support and counseling, plus some sort of either a nicotine replacement or other pharmaceuticals. Those things together are what is most effective. So if you just do one of those things on its own, it's not nearly as effective as doing it in combination.
And yeah, go ahead, Amy.
Well, and the good news about that is that cessation counseling and the medications are covered by insurance. So as part of the Affordable Care Act, smoking cessation is considered an essential health benefit. And so we really do have pretty good coverage. And if you look at our Medicaid program, we have good coverage for cessation counseling and medications. I think there seems to be a lack of awareness, however, among patients and even among healthcare providers that this coverage is available and that there is effective help available. And so I think more could be done to really market that and do outreach to make sure folks know they can get help.
Micah, you've been researching the effects of third-hand smoke. What is that anyway?
Third-hand smoke, you can think of it as what remains behind when someone who's been smoking leaves the room. So okay. Secondhand smoke is the smoke that's coming off of the cigarette while it's being burned or is being exhaled by someone who's smoking. But that smoke doesn't just disappear. It will essentially cover surfaces, whatever's in the room.
Some
of it
smells,
will be
right?
Come back up into the air. So exactly, when you go into a room after someone has smoked, you still get that smell, and that's essentially the third hand smoke that you're experiencing.
And what are the effects?
Well, we don't know a lot about the effects in people, but there's a lot of research that has shown that exposure to the particulate matter in third hand smoke has harmful effects in the lab, so in cell studies and in animal studies. And so there's a lot of work going on. It's actually the state of California that's funding a lot of the work right now, looking at the effects in people. So that we don't know, but it's a particular concern for infants. So infants who spend a lot of time on the floor, so on the carpet, putting their hands in their mouth, that is a particular concern. There are other industries, so people who are involved in cleaning areas where people have been smoking, there might be higher levels of third-hand smoke exposure. So there are certain areas or categories of people where we might be particularly concerned. And there's a new study that just came out from the University of Cincinnati showing that little infants that were coming into the hospital with issues related to asthma or other things that could be triggered by what we would normally think of as secondhand smoke exposure, when you took a swipe from the palm of their hands, you actually saw very high levels of nicotine on their hands.
And Amy Bush Stevens, what's the likelihood that a child who grows up around second or third hand smoke is going to become a smoker themselves? Is there a correlation?
Well, we definitely know that there are immediate negative effects on children from just the exposure to secondhand mm-hmm. smoke in terms of things like asthma and ear infections. And research is even finding impacts on behavior and cognitive functioning in children. I'm not really familiar with the research on the likelihood of, you know, if you have a parent who smokes, your likelihood of smoking.
Yeah.
Like, are you familiar
with that? I don't know the number offhand, but there's certainly a much higher likelihood of being a smoker if your parents were smokers. And there are probably a number of factors that play into that. Some of it is obviously social influences, but it also seems that exposure to smoke, even in utero, seems to make it more likely that someone, if they start smoking later on, will become more easily addicted.
What do we know? What do you know? What the high point was of smoking in the United States, Amy?
think it was probably in the 60s.
Yeah. So the Surgeon General's first report on smoking and health came out in 1964, so more than 50 years ago. And the peak was just a little bit before that. It actually started to go down a little bit when
and
that
report came
out.
And how many people were smoking back then?
So it was about half of adult males, and it was a little lower for females. So we've made a ton of progress since then, but still have a still a little less than 20% nationally now. So we've cut that in more than half, but still a long way to go.
So a little less than 20% nationally at 22% in the state of Ohio. Mm-hmm. Not good for our bottom line, not good for our health. Thanks to both of you for joining us. Amy Bush Stevens, Vice President of Prevention and Public Health Policy at the Health Policy Institute of Ohio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also Micah Berman, Assistant Professor in the College of Public Health at OSU. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. According to the International Labor Organization, Americans are working longer and harder hours than ever before. For many, that means high-pressure, take-no-prisoners work culture that leads to stress, which can affect sleep, overall health, and happiness. More employers are taking note of the toll on an employee's well-being and that it affects the company's bottom line. Kenton Beachy is the executive director at Mental Health America of Franklin County. He has developed a program funded by the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services to bolster healthy workplaces. He joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. It's my pleasure to be here.
How do you measure a healthy workplace? What are the factors that go into that?
Well, what we found through some extensive research is that there are really about 11 drivers of what we call workplace well-being. And those are the things that we always think about at work. How am I getting along with my colleagues? Are my supervisors giving me the support I need? Am I being taken into consideration when there are organizational decisions that are being made? Am I emotionally exhausted? Am I just disengaged from my work? So there are about 11 of those altogether that we found a way to measure, and then we can apply that to each individual workplace.
And is this something you survey workers on, employees on?
There are a number of tools we use in what we call our assessment process. So the first one is a survey. We have about an 80-item survey that takes about 10 or 15 minutes for an employee to complete, and they're able to do that online. And then that gives us a baseline to understand how those employees are scoring in different areas. So we do some pretty deep dive research, some statistical analysis of those data results. And then we go back in armed with what we need to explore more through focus groups. So we'll meet in, let's say, 5 focus groups with 8 to 10 staff members in each group and really dig into the things that they were talking about and find out new stuff that we didn't know. And then we'll also look at some HR records. We can look at exit interview summaries, absenteeism data, turnover rates. So it's really a comprehensive package of looking at what's going on in that unique workplace.
Is it typical that most people in any given workplace that dissatisfaction is not an isolated situation?
What we find is varying rates of dissatisfaction.
Okay.
So we ask a separate question about, you know, overall job satisfaction. And we find anywhere from 25 to 50% of the people are somewhat to very dissatisfied with their workplace. And so we can find out more then about what's causing their dissatisfaction. So it's not uncommon. But there are also an equally strong number of people who are very satisfied with their workplaces.
And that's pretty typical.
In the arena that we're working in, which is with behavioral health organizations.
Okay. All right. How do you know when you're in an unhealthy work situation?
Well, I think just intuitively, employees know what that feels like. So if somebody's talking down to me, if I'm feeling harassed or bullied at work— if I feel as if nobody cares about what's important to me, if my supervisor only sees me once a year, those are the kinds of things that we pick up on at work, whether it's going well or it's not going well. So there's a factor of rewards and how much investment an employee puts into a job. So there's sort of a contractual understanding that when I start a job, I'm going to give everything I have to it, and I'm expecting certain rewards back. Those rewards can be money, but it's also just a satisfaction in what I'm doing. So when that balance is off, every employee feels that. So I'm putting in more than what I'm getting back at work. So then I'm going to disengage, or I'm going to take my stress home. I'm just not going to care about what I'm doing. So those are the things that we all feel in our jobs. And then our job is to classify those and really understand the dynamics and what's going on. And each workplace is different from another one. We find things at one workplace that we don't find at another, or there are some similarities too. So the strength of what we do is we don't look at the general research and say, well, if you have a morale problem, this is a menu of stuff that you can do. Mm-hmm. We start at the beginning, like any diagnostic testing, and we say, what's the problem? So we first figure out what the issues are, and then we know where to focus our efforts to try to improve things.
We're talking about workplace, a healthy workplace, I guess, is what we want to talk about. If you think you work at a healthy workplace, if you think you have it good right now, give us a call and tell us what you think makes up why it's good. 614-292-8513. You mentioned burnout as a driver in that list. How is burnout a driver? I would have thought it might be was a consequence of an unhealthy workplace.
Well, the burnout takes place from what I experience in my workplace. Mm-hmm. So there could be things about the workplace that could burn anybody out, mm-hmm. or there could be things that happen that wouldn't have to happen that burn me out. So particularly in the area of healthcare where we're working right now, the clinicians who are seeing clients have a high level of burnout just by the nature of the relationship that they form with the patients that they're seeing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of emotional investment. There's a real strong uncertainty about whether the effort that the clinician is putting in is going to pay off somehow. So there's just a high burnout rate in the behavioral health field in general. So burnout is actually made up of two different parts. One is emotional exhaustion. So there are people who say, when I go home after a day's work, I'm tired. When I get up in the morning, I'm tired. When I spend the weekend trying to relax and I go back into work on Monday, I'm tired. So that's a problem. That's quite common in the behavioral health field, but that happens in other areas too. And then a second factor in burnout is just my level of engagement. So the person who's engaged is the person who gets to work and the next thing they know it's lunchtime, or they forget to eat lunch because they're just so involved in what they're doing. And that engaged person is the person who's probably satisfied with their work and time flies by. But the person who's experiencing all these stressors at work, they're going to become disengaged much faster. And then that's what creates the burnout.
Feeling guilty, I never miss lunch. So you're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. How does this translate to employers? I mean, let me ask you this. As far as the employer goes, or the supervisor, who's ever in charge, how much of the workplace wellness is a function of their wellness?
What we find is that the environment that's set usually comes from the top management. So I've done focus groups and talked with employees who will say, our CEO is a person who just cares about relationships. He or she knows the names of the people who work here. So they see how the top management is behaving, and that really sets the tone. But what we find, too, is that middle management is another crucial place where things need to happen. Because let's say there's an organization of 300 people in Northeast Ohio. And one of the problems that the employees have there is that they feel as if what's important to them isn't being taken into account when the top management is making decisions. So there are policies and procedures that are being developed that seem totally disconnected from what's going on in the field. So the middle managers are the crucial people in that equation because they convey to the upper management what the line staff are saying. And when the upper management makes these decisions, the middle management is responsible to translate them to the line staff. So that's where the relationships are formed that are really what we call the positive sentiment override that's created in a workplace. That's the glue and creates an environment where people can work things out.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air with Kenton Beachy of the Mental Health America of Franklin County. Hi, Mike.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a quick question. How might an employer who is through a series of mistakes or bad choices, someone who's created a kind of hostile work environment or like a negative atmosphere, how might they enact like a reset or any suggestions for how to kind of change the atmosphere that they've created? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Mike. Thank you.
Well, that's really a very good question. And where I would start is that employer who's made the bad decisions actually the one who's wanting to turn things around? That's really the first point. Is that employer saying, okay, we need to do this a little differently and we want to care a little bit more about people? So if that person is interested, a process like ours can be really helpful because we don't make generalities about what caused that or what's going on in that workplace. We'll come in and do this diagnostic work, talking to people and surveying opinions and ideas in order to get a concrete idea of what actually went wrong. So, for example, if the problem in that workplace is that a lot of people are leaving and there's high turnover, through this process that we go through, we can actually determine what are the main drivers of that turnover. So then we can suggest things that have been successful in other places or that have come out through research about what can be done to change the needle on why people are leaving.
I was wondering, you've gathered data in your study from nearly 1,400 employees at 10 behavioral health agencies across the state. How does that extrapolate to other kinds of work environments, loading docks, computer programming, librarians? I mean, you know, the whole gamut.
The 11 drivers that we've isolated that really affect workplace being are universal. So those apply to any workplace. But then there are things that differ from one workplace to another. So, for example, I took kind of a mid-year or a mid-career break, and for 9 years I was a woodworker. So I went to a wood shop to build custom cabinets and got there at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I had a half-hour lunch, and I left at 3 o'clock, or 3:30 actually, and that was my job. I didn't take it home. I went in and I worked with my hands, which studies show is refreshing and good for your mental health to begin with, and I didn't have to take my job home with me. The biggest struggles I had were what kind of relationships I had while I was there, and of course that I wasn't getting paid enough,
mm-hmm.
But that's beside the point. So what I'm saying is that it depends on what the workplace is like. So the kind of work that I do now, I'm thinking about it all the time. I go home and I think about it at night and over the weekend, and I work long hours. But I've agreed to do that, and I have good relationships with the people I work with funders, with the community, and so it's a very rewarding experience. So I'm willing to put that time in. So there are those kinds of variables that are different in different workplaces, and it can depend on what kind of occupation it is.
And different people. I mean,
sure.
Some people don't need to derive that kind of satisfaction from their job. They get it other ways.
Yes, that's true. But I think one factor to consider is that when we spend 40 to 60 hours of our week at work,
yeah,
that's a significant impact in our lives, no matter whether we derive satisfaction from it or not. I mean, it may be more time than we spend with our children or with our loved ones.
Do you think employers need to think about and are thinking about or getting better at thinking about how a new hire is going to fit into the organization?
I think that's a growing concern. Generally, what I see in the field is that employers are being more concerned about the workplace environment because it affects their bottom line. It's far more expensive to have somebody leave and retrain and replace them than it is to put the energy and time and money into keeping them.
Mm-hmm.
So in that vein, employers are realizing that there are certain types of people that they need to hire and certain types of people that they probably need to stay away from, depending on what the job is. So there's more care being taken in trying to make a good match to begin with, because that match is probably going to stick, and there's a higher rate of retention with someone who's well-matched with the job that they're hired to do.
Again, going back to the behavioral health agency's point of this, there does tend to be a lot of turnover because it's a very stressful field. There are other places where there's not a lot of turnover at all. But in general, there's this trend toward just moving on, they're saying this new generation will have 10 or 15 jobs or 5 or 6 careers before they retire, unlike ours. How does that play into this?
Well, I think there's more fluidity in where people live, what they want out of a job. So I think the newest generation that's coming into jobs has a much different idea of what's going to be rewarding to them. They may care more about the mission and how people are actually being helped than so much about how much they're being paid or how long they're going to work there. So employers need to recognize that different generations of workers have different things that reward them, and they're going to keep them there or cause them to leave. So I think those are some of the factors to consider.
And also, a lot of people are working more than one job. How does that play into it? They're juggling a lot of different personalities in different ways.
That's really true. When I sit down in focus groups with employees who are really out on the front line, so in behavioral health care, for example, there are people called CPST workers who have a lot more day-to-day client activity. They're out helping the clients go to an appointment or whatever. And by virtue of the training that they need for that job, which is – so they need to be less qualified to do that. The pay is a little bit lower. So if somebody's working for minimum wage or $10 an hour, what they're telling me in the focus groups is I have to work a second job. Or in some cases, if I'm a single parent, I might have to work a third job in order to make ends meet. So definitely that's a factor.
Yeah. Well, Kent and BG, lots of things to talk about and think about going forward about workplace health. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Been my pleasure. Thank you.
Kent and BG, Executive Director of Mental Health America of Franklin County. We're going to move on. We are going to be talking about diapers coming up. So if you have a question about diapers, I'd love to have you queue up with that. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The average infant uses more than 2,700 diapers, costing a total of more than $550 in the first year alone. That means some low-income families have to choose between food and diapers sometimes. That's a big expense. Columbus Birth and Parenting is holding its No Child Wet Behind diaper drive and fundraiser in May. For more information, check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides. We're talking about the diaper shortage in Central Ohio and the health and safety of diapers. Joining us by phone from Wisconsin is recently retired pediatrician and a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Dr. Ellen Schumann. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also with us is doula and owner of Columbus Birth and Parenting, Katie Mail. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Katie, tell us about the diaper shortage in Columbus today. What do we mean by that?
Yeah, so diaper shortage or diaper need is the lack of supply of diapers to keep a baby or toddler clean, dry, and healthy. It affects about 1 in 3 families in across the United States. And in Columbus, it's about 12,000 babies every year who don't have enough diapers.
It's not that there's a shortage. There's just not enough money to pay for them.
Correct. Diapers are not covered by SNAP benefits or food stamps, so families have to pay out of pocket for that. And if they have to choose between food and diapers, then they have to make that choice and they might not be able to provide an adequate number of diapers. And most babies need about 6 to 10 diapers a day.
Mm-hmm. And they get more and more expensive.
Yes, they do.
How much are they now?
Diapers, on average, a month, it'll cost between $80 and $150 a month to just diaper one baby.
Hmm. Dr. Schumann, is this a thing? I mean, across the country, is there a problem with affording diapers?
Yes, I believe there is. And it's unfortunately for these young families, sometimes it's not just limited to not being able to afford diapers. It's also not being able to afford sometimes formula and other things. But yes, that's a very real thing for people who are living on the edge of the poverty line.
How did you find out about this this problem, this shortage?
The National No Child Left Behind put out a call at a conference that I was attending last year, and they brought this need to my attention. But I've seen it personally. I have family members who I've purchased diapers for because they were not able to afford them themselves. And their babies have horrible diaper rashes and cry a lot more than other babies.
Because they're just not changing them as often?
Correct.
They're just leaving a dirty diaper on them.
Some families have to empty out a dirty diaper into the trash and put it back on their baby.
All right. So, Dr. Schumann, what does that do?
Well, the skin under the diaper is very delicate skin, especially in a baby. The skin layers are relatively thin compared to the skin of an older child or an adult. And once you break the defenses of that skin barrier, and especially in the diaper area where it's moist and it's dark and it's all, you know, it's wet, and there are lots of enzymes and irritants from urine and stool, the skin breaks down easily. And once you've broken down the skin defenses, and then diaper rashes spread quickly and are very difficult to clear up. And also, if you do clear them up, the integrity of your skin is never quite the same. The skin's a bit weaker, and so it's even easier to get the next diaper rash.
So you're saying that people are reusing diapers. So they're emptying out, you know, when it's feces, they're emptying that out, but then they have to put a wet diaper back on.
Yes. Yeah. Some babies will be in the same diaper for 24 or 48 hours at a time because the parents don't have an adequate supply.
Besides community diaper programs, is there any federal aid to help families afford diapers? You're saying that women, infants, and children, they don't help? Food stamps don't help?
No, they do not cover diapers. So food banks, diaper banks are the way that families get diapers. We've partnered with the Columbus Diaper Bank and Moms-to-Be to provide diapers to their families. And our goal this year is to raise 100,000 diapers in Columbus.
At what point do you – let's talk about cloth versus disposable. Why – is that part of this thing? I mean, is there – Katie, does that help? I mean, if you went to cloth, for instance, and could just wash your own diapers?
Sure. Cloth is a great option for some families, but the reality is that most low-income families live in places where they have group laundry facilities,
right,
and they don't allow – they often don't allow.
Sometimes Why?
They do. Well, because other people are washing their clothes, and they don't really want to wash their clothes in a washing machine that just had feces in it. And then also daycare facilities. Many daycare facilities do not allow cloth diapers as well because it's a biohazard.
Dr. Schumann, thoughts about disposable versus cloth?
Well, in terms of if, you know, all things being equal – Now, with the newer diapers available now that have new technology in them, and that's basically the gel technology, so it's whenever the urine hits the inside of the diaper, then the material that's there turns the liquid urine to gel, so it keeps it away from the skin and keeps the moisture away from the baby's skin.
Uh-huh.
Once we had that kind of technology in diapers, there is absolutely no doubt that the safer, the best way to protect the skin in the diaper area is by using a disposable diaper with that technology. Now, that said, you can still have use cloth diapers and do pretty well with diaper rash, but you have to change those diapers frequently. You know, when they're wet or when they're dirty, they need to be changed. And then you've got to be very good about how you clean them. You know, when you're doing cloth diapers, that's just not a matter of throwing those diapers in the wash. You know, you have to pre-soak them and clean them and everything. So there's a lot of to-do associated with keeping cloth diapers in good condition to use on a baby as well. And that costs money, too.
How so? What do you mean?
Well, there's a cost to, having enough diapers so you can cycle through them and keep them clean, because obviously you don't want to be washing a load that just has two diapers in them. You pretty much have to wash a load with diapers only. They have to be soaked before you clean them, and then they need to be washed. They need to be washed with bleach so that you're sure you're cleaning all the bacteria and stuff that are in them. So they have to be washed in hot water. So there's costs associated with that. There's water, or if you're paying for loads in the, you know, loads in the laundromat to be able to do those. There's a cost associated with that as well.
And as far as leaving a diaper, you said with the disposables, you know, it pulls the moisture away from the skin. It makes it a little bit safer on that score. But eventually, they do get wet, right? Putting a disposable back on a baby is not a good option.
No, it's not a good option because eventually the diaper has absorbed all the urine that it can absorb, you know, and then you need to get that diaper changed. And obviously if the baby has had a stool in that diaper, there's no way that you can get that diaper clean before you place it back on a baby. And when we're talking about stool, there are lots of enzymes and chemicals that come through the stool that are irritating to the skin. So it's really impossible to just wipe all those things off a diaper if it's been soiled.
If you have a question or comment about diapers, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Katie Mail, when somebody doesn't have enough diapers when they go to the food pantry, hopefully there are diapers there. I know that's a big thing. Mm-hmm. But how do they meet them out if there's that much of a shortage?
You know, that's a great question. I don't actually know the answer to that. If the family says that they need diapers, then we trust them and we give them the diapers. But we've also partnered with Moms-to-Be so that the moms who go through their program will get diapers every time that they go to the program,
okay.
Their weekly group that they go to.
Are there other ways? Are the diaper companies helping in any way?
That's a great question, too. No, not us, at least. They have not helped us at all. But certainly the diaper banks are able to purchase diapers for a lot less than what you or I are able to just go to the store and purchase them for. And so that's the great thing about especially financial donations to No Child Wet Behind or to the
local
diaper banks.
Because they can get them in bulk.
Yes.
I was interested when I was reading about this that a lot of people nowadays, they just order bulk from Amazon or something mm-hmm. like that, and they're delivered to the house, and people with greater means are actually paying a lot less
yes.
for a diaper than somebody who is struggling economically.
Yes, absolutely. Someone who's struggling, they might have to go to the corner store where a pack of diapers, they're only going to be able to get a small one, and it's going to cost significantly more than being able to go to Costco or Sam's Club and buy a large amount at one time.
You know, Dr. Schumann, did you come across this in your practice when you found people, babies with diaper rash, and you talk to the parents? Are they humiliated? I mean, this has got to be a rough thing to talk about.
Fortunately for me, that really never happened. Where I live, we had a program we could refer parents to that were having issues with, you know, like not enough diapers, not enough formula. And so we always had a way to get help for those patients. And fortunately, I did not have that problem with my patients facing that so much.
Do you think the disposable diaper revolution has been a good thing or not?
I think it's a great thing.
Yeah.
It certainly makes life a lot easier. And I did a combination of disposable and cloth. And if I had a kid again, I would probably do disposables. They're just a lot easier. And especially if you're working more than one job,
uh-huh.
the amount of time that it takes to cloth diaper. Again, they're a great option for some, but not for everybody.
But they're not cheap.
Yeah.
Dr. Schumann?
They aren't cheap. But I think the main thing is now, you know, The disposable diapers that are available now, because as I said, of that new technology where the urine hits and turns to gel, it's just so much better for the integrity and of the baby's skin. In addition to the convenience, if you are able to afford it, it's definitely the way to go.
So you have diaper rash, your kid has diaper rash. What do you do?
Well, the first thing is that you need to try to get the skin to heal. So one of the first things is keeping the diaper area especially clean. So that means changing diapers as soon as they're dirty or wet. so that you keep chemicals and enzymes off the skin. You also want to put a protective barrier on the area where the rash is so that it has a chance to heal. Now, that in itself can cost some money if you're, you know, need to go out to the store and pick up a, you know, a barrier ointment.
Like a Desitin or something like that?
Like Desitin or triple paste or something like that, yeah. Now, and, you know, for people that have limited means, you know, people have in the past tried things like just plain zinc oxide or even Crisco, you know, solid Crisco, you know, things like that if they needed to in a pinch.
Okay.
Which is good. And then, you know, for wipe, for cleaning the baby off, then you have the issue of do you use wipes, do you use water, what do you use? And you need to be careful there because when you have open, raw skin, you know, you don't want to make that hurt and sting, you know, as you're cleaning it. So that's another issue of what do you use. Now, they do make wipes that are supposed to be pH balanced and unscented and all, you know, few chemicals in them. That's good. Those cost some money.
Exactly.
We've had people use, you know, water, you know, which is fine, but that tends to sting. One of the things that I used to have my patients do is to pick up a, you know, a bottle of, you know, mineral oil, just, you know, real cheap mineral oil, and put that on a soft paper towel or on some, like, I'm going to say Viva brand because it's a very soft towel, or on some cotton ball and use that to cleanse the baby's skin because that's gentle and allows you to clean the skin well. And then you just slather whatever you got on there and try to protect it.
I'm going to take a quick call here. Ellen in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question for both guests. Kind of wanted to get their opinion. If either of you have heard about a trend, I guess you could say, and there's some catchy name for it, of training very, very young infants to use the toilet. There are... I'm not kidding. There are actually YouTube videos.
Well, I mean, you hear about people... abusing their children because they're not using the toilet properly. Dr. Schumann?
Well, if you look, go back in many civilizations, there are a lot of civilizations that really don't use diapers or have their kids out of diapers quickly. If you can, if your child is with you all the time, you're really keyed into their physical signs that they need to use the toilet, you know, then placing them on the toilet is something that is done. You know, so that depends a lot on, you know, the person that's with the child being able to be physically in contact with them, really being able to key into their body signals and signs. In order to do that, it takes a lot of dedication, and it's not something, and a lot of time. And then you have to be with your child a lot. And in today's society, I think that's really difficult for a lot of people because they aren't. I mean, they're working, the kids are in daycare, they're with multiple other people.
Katie Mail?
Yeah, what she was referring to is called elimination communication. And just like the doctor said, it's something that it's an advantage to be able to do that, or a privilege, because you have to be a stay-at-home parent to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And it does require a lot of time and paying attention to your baby's cues. And that's just not a realistic option for most women, especially low-income women who are working or working multiple jobs. And there's enough stress and pressure put on women to do all the things, and we don't need, I don't feel like that extra thing. And not being able to supply diapers for a baby affects, believe it or not, it affects a woman's mental health more than not having enough food. So to say, like, just do elimination communication, that's great for some people. And for the people who have this diaper need, it's not a realistic and viable
option. It's not really a choice.
Correct.
Katie Mail, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank
I appreciate your time. Katie Mail, doula and owner of Columbus Birth and Parenting. Columbus Birth and Parenting is holding its No Child Wet Behind diaper drive and fundraiser in May. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also, Dr. Ellen Schumann, recently retired board-certified pediatrician and fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics in Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Schumann.
You're very welcome.
And thanks to everybody for listening. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.